Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, I can't believe I'm saying this, but this is our final scoop for the month of August as we're quickly moving into September. So I'm so glad to see you as we start moving towards the unofficial end of summer, which probably already feels like it's upon you if you've already started back to like a more serious work schedule or more serious school schedule. It certainly has been, and you hear that, a knock on wood. You know, when we get into the final week of August before Labor Day, you get a lot of people taking vacation. You get a little bit of a natural slowdown when it comes to the news. But we know that doesn't really matter because anytime I say something like that, there's going to be a big news story. So welcome to Scoop at Smarter News. And hopefully we didn't jinx ourselves for the next several days. But this is the final week of August. And then we're officially into fall. And we got a lot of big topics that we know are on the horizon for fall. A lot of big topics that we're going to tackle today. But for those of you who are anxious for fall to welcome fall in, maybe you're already burning that candle, you know, the fall foliage candle. Does everyone have one of those? You already got one of those going in the house? Maybe it's just wishful thinking because you're in Texas like I am, and you're already, you know, continue to see that 100-degree weather. However, nationwide, we're going to experience something together. We experienced it a little bit already this weekend. My friend Mel said this, also a Scoop insider. Shout out to Mel. She said, you know, I walked outside. It was just, there's a little breeze, little freshness to the breeze, not too fresh, little freshness to the breeze. It's because we're actually seeing a cool down over the next several days in the United States. And so what you're seeing on your screen right now is the National Weather Service Weather Prediction Center. And what you can see is really nationwide. Now, I know you're getting a heat wave if you're in the Pacific Northwest. By the way, we have to watch out for flash flood warnings in parts of the country as well, because this is bringing some wetter weather. But by Tuesday, Wednesday, we're seeing overall much cooler temperatures, 10 to 30 degrees lower than average in some places. So I don't have what things look like going into Labor Day weekend, but at least for now, that's where we are at this time. So maybe you're going to be able to grab a sweater. I don't know. Maybe you're already doing that. And if you already are, I want the early pictures of the leaves changing color, but we're probably moving a little too fast, but I was excited about seeing this. And as I was looking at our live chat today, thank you to all of our Smarter News insiders who are joining us live. There was a lot of conversation about weather. So I think we're all feeling a little anxiety about moving into the fall. Before we get to some of the harder politics that we're going to get to today. We have a little bit of politics. We got the president already active this Monday morning. We have some big topics to talk about regarding immigration and cell phone bans in schools as well, as we're going to talk about getting into fall and the back to school season. I also just want to briefly just mention sports. The U.S. Open is taking place. It's going to continue until really the first week through the first week of September. There's some history being made there as far as tennis goes. Venus Williams is back on the courts. And I appreciate what's been said about this story so far, because some have said, you know, all journalists are talking about is her age. But the reason why we're talking about that is because it is history making. At 45 years old, she's the oldest single U.S. Open player in 44 years. And so she's back on the courts, her 25th time there. And so something that you could pay attention to, something that you're able to kind of, maybe you're not a tennis fan, but that's something to watch out of the corner of your eye this week. We'll be watching her in New York. And there's also this great story out of golf. So we talk about, you know, being a gracious loser. That's something that you try to instill upon your kids sometimes, right? And it's hard to do. Who likes to lose? We all like to win. So if I told you this person went 0 for 163, that sounds like a lot. I mean, it is a lot. That's how many PGA tournaments that Tommy Fleetwood has played in and how many he has not won until this past weekend. And it was a big one. It was the FedEx Cup Championship. He won $10 million by being the top player. I know. By the way, I looked at the winnings. I was curious about this. I was like, how much do you win in golf? Is it, you know, top 3, 4, 5? No, you could be the 30th runner up and you get a couple hundred thousand dollars. You guys, we're playing. If any of us played any other sport, we were in the wrong sports. You can come in 25th and you make a good living. And so I mentioned that because even though he didn't win a tournament and he won $10 million this time, he has been a very winning golfer and made a few million dollars in the meantime. But he had something great to say at the end of this when he was asked about keeping his spirits up and what it's like to win. And I thought you would enjoy the soundbite.
I was near misses and berate myself and make it worse. Like, I want to be a positive impact on myself. And I know that what I want to do is I want to get in contention again. I want to play against the best players in the world and I want to win the biggest tournaments. I'm not going to be able to do that if I have a negative attitude, if I have a poor attitude. So I try to be positive about everything and say the right things inwardly and outwardly. And then I guess people liked what I was saying. They liked the attitude that I had. Again, I go back to my kids. That's the things that I want those to be like. You know, it's easy to say that you're resilient, but it's harder when you have to be resilient. And I think I feel lucky that I've had to show that side of myself. I feel lucky that actually paid off and that I won.
Isn't that true? We can all talk about resiliency, how important it is. But when you're in the thick of it, it's hard. It's really hard. That's why not everyone is resilient. So I thought that was a really nice kind of way to frame this week and think about perhaps you're going through some tough times and here's somebody who, sure, he had some success, but it's nice to be a winner and to be at the top of that list after so many years of working hard. And so he was able to do that this weekend. So congratulations to him. Someone we know who likes to play golf is the president. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in Washington, D.C. The president was very active Monday morning. We're going to talk about those executive actions in just a second. But before I do, I just want to mention one more time that we're still in this period where Congress is back in their home districts. And it really is until after Labor Day that they're going to start making their way back to Washington, D.C. And they have quite a few things in front of them. We'll get to that in September. But just so you know, one of the reasons why we're not seeing a ton of lawmakers on television, you're getting a ton of sound bites from them, it's because they're not in front of the cameras, the national cameras that are always available in Washington, D.C. for commentary. So really the president has the microphone. And that may feel like that's the case normally because the president has a lot of public events. He likes speaking to the press, but more so than ever at this time. And so that's important to realize as you're kind of taking in, well, what is the news that I'm seeing today? And a lot of that has to do with the president being able to really drive the news cycle out of Washington, D.C., at least from a federal government perspective. So this morning, he was appearing before camera in the Oval Office. He had a few members of his cabinet behind him, and there were a few executive actions that he was introducing. One was an executive action regarding burning the American flag. And what the president put forward is that someone could be prosecuted for that. Now, there is Supreme Court precedent that one can burn the American flag in the United States as a form of a freedom of expression. So there's legal precedent for that. And the executive action in the wording does leave some room for that, basically saying within what's legally available to the Justice Department. So the president put forward that executive action today. And you have to watch these things because it's important. Whatever White House says, Republican, Democrat, doesn't really matter. When the president puts forward an executive action, we want to pay attention to that. We also know executive actions are somewhat limited because really the power comes from a change in law. And it's an insight into what the White House wants to talk about today. So maybe the White House doesn't really want to talk about, let's say, the war between Russia and Ukraine, what's going on between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, but they're going to put forward a different topic. And as a journalist, I want to cover that topic for you and also say, well, we're also going to pay attention to some of these other stories too. So that's one of the topics that was put forward today. The other executive action was about cashless bail. You might have heard that term quite a bit. So this is, you know, think about it just as it sounds. If I was arrested for something and I'm being held awaiting trial, I can be bailed out in most situations unless a judge decides that I don't have that access. And in certain areas of the country, there's cashless bail, meaning that I'm able to get out of prison or where I'm being held for the promise of returning for the trial, not necessarily for $500 or $1,000 or whatever it may be. And that's being held upon my return. So some have suggested that cashless bail is allowing more and more criminals that, you know, and I have to say alleged criminals because perhaps they have not been prosecuted, perhaps they don't have a record. But let's say repeat offenders go back into the streets more easily to again break the law because of the quickness that they're in and out of being held awaiting prosecution. So this has been a controversial topic. There are those that say, well, that's unfair because if you have money, that means that you're never going to be held. You're always going to be bailed out. And if you don't have money, then you have to stay behind bars awaiting your trial, which could take a really long time. So it's not fair. That's one of the arguments. There's many arguments against this policy. So what the White House put out today was an executive action that basically said that there's going to be work done over the next 30 days and a report is going to be given to the Justice Department about which areas of the country are using cashless bail and that there would be the potential to withhold some federal funds if they continue to do so. This is underneath the umbrella of law and order that the president has put forward and talked about regarding Washington, D.C. and other places. So something that's not necessarily leading to a change right now in this moment, but something that you should know about. The president was asked about a couple other things, including what's happening between Russia and Ukraine. And think about this. Think about what we were talking about last Monday. Last Monday was a huge meeting of European leaders at the White House. We didn't know what was going to take place. We just were coming off the Alaska summit with Vladimir Putin and a question about, is there a way forward to peace? We ended that meeting on Monday, not with a ton of new news. And we ended last week, not with a ton of new news. And so the president was asked about this today.
Summit here with Ukrainian President Zelensky, European leaders all met here with you at the White House. You said you wanted to get this done bilateral as soon as possible. Have you spoken to Putin since last Monday?
Yeah, I have.
What is your conversation? Can you share?
Every conversation I have with him is a good conversation. And then unfortunately, a bomb is loaded up into Kiev or someplace, and then I get very angry about it. I think we're going to get the war done. It's tough. I thought that would be, of the seven that I settled, I thought that would be the easiest of the group. See, you never know what's going to happen. You know, war, strange things happen in war. The fact that he went to Alaska, our country, I think was a big statement that he wants to get it done. That was not easy for him to go to Alaska, you know, for him to come here. But the fact that he showed up on a very successful, that was a very successful day for other things, because, you know, we're also talking about missiles, nuclear. We're talking about a lot of different things. We're talking about limiting nuclear weapons. We'll get China into that. We have the most. Russia has the second most and China has third. But China is way behind, but they'll catch us in 5 years. We would like to denuclearize. It's too much power. And we talked about that also. That's part of it. But we have to get the war over with.
So that's sort of interesting, the president saying, yeah, we were talking about Ukraine, but it was really bigger than that, which isn't exactly how we went into that summit, about 10 days ago. But you see the president talking through why he still thinks it was positive to meet with Vladimir Putin, but also expressing some frustrations. Let me just show you this real quick. This is from the Associated Press, and you don't need to zoom in on it to really understand what's going on here. What this is showing is drone strikes on Ukraine by Russia. And what you're seeing in the big bar graph is the number of drone strikes. So these are the number of drones that are being sent into Ukrainian territory. The smaller bar graph, which is a brighter red, is showing us the number of actual hits. That hasn't gone up as dramatically as the sheer number of attacks. So it's what this is showing overall, the big takeaway, though, if I can cut through some of that, I just want to explain what you're seeing on your screen, is that Russia has ramped up attacks on Ukraine, including in the days following the meeting between President Trump and President Putin, and also in this week following the European leaders meeting in Washington, D.C. So if we look at this strictly from a question of has Russia changed behavior, if we look at the graph or we look at the reports coming out of Ukraine, no. And in fact, what we've seen is more aggressiveness by Russia. This is something that Kristen Welker of Meet the Press asked the vice president about. She sat down with Vice President Vance. She asked him about a few different things, including what to make of Russia striking a factory in Ukraine that apparently was an American-owned factory. Russia claims that it was actually a factory being used to produce military equipment. Ukraine denies that. The company denies that. So this covers a lot of ground. But this was a key question that she asked Vice President Vance, and I want you to take a listen to this.
Russians stringing President Trump along?
No, not at all, Kristen. I think the Russians have made significant concessions to President Trump for the first time in 3.5 years of this conflict. They've actually been willing to be flexible on some of their core demands. They've talked about what would be necessary to end the war. Of course, they haven't been completely there yet, or the war would be over, but we're engaging in this diplomatic process in good faith. We are trying to negotiate as much as we can with both the Russians and the Ukrainians to find a middle ground to stop the killing. I think what the president has tried to do here is try to engage in very aggressive, very energetic diplomacy, because this war is not in anyone's interest. It's not in Europe or the United States' interest. We don't think it's in Russia or Ukraine's interest to keep going. So we're going to keep on pushing for a diplomatic solution. And one final point about this, Kristen, if you look historically, whenever you have a complicated war with a lot of death and destruction, it kind of goes in fits and starts. There are hills and valleys to the negotiation. We sometimes feel like we've made great progress with the Russians. And sometimes, as the president has said, he's been very frustrated with the Russians. And we're going to keep on doing what we have to do to bring this thing to a close. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. I think that we're going to continue to make progress. But ultimately, whether the killing stops, that determination is going to belong to whether the Russians and the Ukrainians can actually find some middle ground here.
Interesting. So this is Vice President Vance giving his assessment of what's happening. What's interesting is Kristen Welker actually spoke with the foreign minister of Russia, which is very rare to have him speak to the press in this way on a Sunday show. It's not, he's done it plenty of times before. Sergey Lavrov, he's been a figure in Russia for decades. And she's really trying to pin him down about what Russia's agreeing to. And so she was asking Sergey Lavrov, well, is Vladimir Putin going to meet with President Zelensky? Like, this is what's been coming up. Is this happening, this trilateral meeting that we've heard a little bit about, the White House on Monday? Is that progress? Because everyone's looking for, well, what's the actual news? Is there a news nugget of progress, or are we just getting the news of more attacks from Russia? And remember what David Satter told us just last week, who is seeped in Russian history and with a very unique perspective on Russian culture and leadership. He said, this is what Russia does. They're going to prolong this conversation. They're going to have a different conversation in public than what we're having behind closed doors. And it's all sort of this sleight of hands. This was his assessment. I want you to see this interaction because we don't get this very often between Kristen Welker and Sergey Lavrov when she's pushing him on, wait a minute, is President Putin going to meet with President Zelensky or not?
Kristen, I am awfully sorry. You're not listening. There is no meeting planned, and I'm not challenging this. But you cannot, I think, understand what I am saying. Putin is ready to meet with Zelensky. When the agenda would be ready for a summit, and this agenda is not ready at all. President Trump suggested, after Anchorage, several points which we share, and on some of them we agreed to show some flexibility.
Okay.
When President Trump brought those issues to the meeting in Washington, with Zelensky present together with his European sponsors, he clearly indicated, it was very clear to everybody, that there are several principles which Washington believes must be accepted, including no NATO membership, including the discussion of territorial issues. And Zelensky said no to everything.
Okay, Mr. Foreign Minister,
so, yes,
let's keep moving. Let's keep moving.
He is ready to meet. But no, we cannot meet just for him to have a picture and to say that now I am legitimate.
By the way, when you ever have someone that you're interviewing and you're like, I don't think, you hear someone say to you, I don't think you're listening. I don't think you're hearing me. You're like, are you sure you're not hearing me? I think you just don't like the question. That's actually what's happening, but that's okay. That's okay. You can see Kristen Welker doesn't respond to that. She's just going to get the answer. But so you can see the Russians are saying, well, listen, we'll meet, but there's just not a serious agenda on the table. So we're not going to meet just to get President Zelensky a photo op. You know, this is what they're saying. So now you have a little bit from the United States. You have Vice President Vance talking about energetic diplomacy, saying, yeah, we don't love everything that's happening, but we're trying to get these two sides together as a mediator. You have Russia saying, sure, we're open to meeting like sometime in the future, maybe when there's an agenda that we feel is a serious agenda. But here's a list of things. By the way, he spoke for many minutes in an answer, just steamrolling the many things that Russia feels like Ukraine has to agree to in principle or be open to on record in order for this meeting to take place. So here's Adam Schiff, a prominent Democrat. So you get the other side as well, who's talking about his observations as to what's going on here.
They're clearly stringing the president along. And, you know, I think at some we have to start, what's our national security interest? Our national security interest is seeing a strong, sovereign, independent, democratic Ukraine. And measured against that, the summit, I think, was a failure. It didn't advance our interests or Ukraine's interests or that of our allies. Putin walked away with essentially no ceasefire, despite the president's demand for it. He walked away after being on the stage on U.S. soil with U.S. president, literally the red carpet rolled out for him. He walked away out from under the threat of sanctions from the United States. Trump had promised to impose sanctions. So they strung him along successfully. And I think the president, for his part, was correct when he said Ukraine can't win a war if it can't go on offense. But it is the president administration that is preventing Ukraine from going on offense by preventing Ukraine from using weapons to attack Russia on Russian soil. So I think it was a real setback for us. Lavrov, no surprises in his statements, except perhaps in his inability to directly refute the idea that they're stringing along the president.
So that's what Adam Schiff is talking about today. And he is suggesting that this is all just part of the Russians' just ongoing effort to keep the war going because it's benefiting Russia, at least at this time. And that was the argument from David Satter, again, to go back to the interview, which is to say the whole economy right now in Russia is built on a wartime wartime setting. And therefore, if we did put secondary sanctions on to the countries that are customers of Russia, perhaps we could start forcing a change. But there's those that disagree with that, including members of the administration. So where this goes from here, it is tough to know. Celeste asked a great question. She said, just getting on, not sure if this was mentioned, did anyone see something about Ukraine forces striking nuclear sites in Russia? Celeste, I haven't seen that report about striking nuclear sites in Russia. If that's recent, if that's the over the last several days. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. What I will tell you is that Sergey Lavrov was talking about this in the interview as well. And he said, listen, the West likes to talk about Russia's attacks on Ukraine, but you're not covering Ukraine's attacks into Russian territory. And that's also a provocation. And so this is part of what we need to discuss in order for talks to go forward. So at least right now, you have a couple different angles covered. We don't have any big, big news at this moment. And here's one more question that the president answered today as one of his final questions in this sort of press availability that happened in the Oval Office.
Do you think President Putin is so reluctant to meet with President Zelensky?
Because he doesn't like him. You know, they don't like, I have people I don't like. I don't like to meet with them. Sometimes I do like to meet with people I don't like.
So how do you get them together?
They don't like each other, really. And if we had a real president instead of a guy that got in there with a fraudulent election, if we had a real president.
Okay, I'm going to stop the president there. That is an important omission, as simple as it sounds. Because when we look at really complicated topics, and you know how I feel about it when people say, oh, this is complicated, you know, there's no solution to it, no one knows really can understand it unless you have a PhD. No, like life is complicated and we all navigate it on a regular basis. I believe that there are solutions to problems. There's just a question about will. If we can Amazon ourselves toilet paper to show up on our doorstep in a few hours, and if we can send people into outer space, we likely can solve a problem when it comes to a disagreement between nations. The question is, do we have the will? And if these people simply do not like each other, and that's part of the problem, then how do you change that? That's different than saying, well, the negotiations, you know, these things aren't on the table. We just don't like each other. And there's a lot of people that are being hurt in the process there. But I thought, again, kind of this authentic, honest moment from the president to say, yeah, just listen, no love lost between those two. So ongoing, we'll continue to watch this as an ongoing topic and one that continues to be something that the administration has a desire to solve because it was a campaign promise. And the more and more time it takes to move towards some change here in Ukraine, one has to ask the question, and if I was behind the scenes with a White House strategist, because it's a little bit inside baseball, I would ask that question. Like, how does the White House feel like this is impacting their ability to lead on the national stage or impacting the domestic audience? Because the White House cares a lot about this. The question is, do the American people, how do the American people really feel about this? And what's the political calculation behind this? Is this simply a desire to kind of check the box, going back to who's winning and who's losing? Or is there something else going on here politically that maybe we're missing in this story? So I'm curious your thoughts on that, about how much you think the American public is tied directly to this. Speaking of stories that people are emotionally attached to or have been getting a lot of play on social media. And listen, I know that social media is only one barometer, but I saw this video so many times last week, I felt it would be a missed opportunity to talk to you about a topic related to it that actually could help us make us a little bit smarter when it comes to this topic about immigration and who has legal status in the country. So I'm going to show this video. You know, I'm very sensitive about the line between information and exploitation. And in this video, you do see a horrific car crash where several individuals lost their lives. You're seeing a big truck being driven down a highway, makes an illegal turn, and the back of the truck, the semi, is crossing the road. And the car that's coming down the highway can't make enough changes to move and runs right into the truck. And these people lost their lives. And the driver was obviously being pursued by law enforcement after this, because there's a question about this being a homicide. And so what you're seeing on this video is important because we're seeing the images of the driver. And so this led to a question about who this driver is. How did he get his license? What is the backstory here? And as this story developed further, you not only had a shocking viral video, but then you had this revelation that this driver did not have legal status and that he left the state of Florida where this accident happened, went to California, was eventually extradited back to Florida, and the case is ongoing here. What I want to talk to you about today less has to do with this specific case and more about something that you may not realize, which is who actually is able to get a driver's license in the United States. Because there's all these questions. Well, if this person didn't have legal status, then how did they get a driver's license, specifically a commercial driver's license, where they're going to be driving a car something big, a big commercial vehicle that's going to require a certain amount of skill and understanding of law and a certain approval process. So what about that? And this is what I wanted to show you today. Again, taking a viral video and taking a closer look at it. So this is a look at the different states that offer driving privileges to, we're going to use this term here, unauthorized immigrants. So those without legal status. Let me go ahead and pull this up for you so you can see it. And what you're going to see on your screen is the green states that do not offer driving privileges to unauthorized immigrants, and the blue states that offer driving privileges to unauthorized immigrants. So there are actually 19 states right now that offer some sort of driving privilege to somebody who's in this country without legal status. Now, we could probably break that down further. I don't know if that extends directly to commercial driver's license, but in the state of California, where reportedly this individual came across the border, came into the United States, was able to obtain a license, you are able to get a license in the state of California without showing that you have legal status to be in the country. Now, every state has something a little bit different. So this really depends on your point of view when you went and got a driver's license. In some states, you might be like, well, wait a minute, I had to bring my birth certificate and my social security card and my passport, and that's how I was able to get a driver's license. For many of us, we probably got a driver's license when we were in our teenage years. And thank goodness for our parents who probably helped us gather some of that paperwork at the time. So it may not be fresh unless you've moved states and you had to do it again. In the state of Texas, I remember when I moved here, it was tough for me to give up that New York State driver's license that I worked so hard to get coming from California. Let me tell you, the DMV in New York City is a real experience. I remember it many, many hours there. But when I came to Texas, I had to bring certain documentation to show that I was a legal permanent resident in the United States, that I had legal status. And so I had to show them a series of different documents, but that's not the case everywhere. And just knowing that needs to be underscored, because if you don't have if you're not legally present in the country, you're still able to get a driver's license. And when you're able to get a driver's license, oftentimes you're able to do a series of other things. You have a series of other privileges. You know, what that looks like, again, depends on different states. There's one change to this, and that's the Real ID. So remember, the Real ID legislation was passed after 9/11 in 2005, and it said in 20 years, we're going to have this Real ID. And what the Real ID represents, and that's what we all talked about, we have to have that Real ID now to get on a plane. And it's going to show that you are legally present in the United States. So that means that, you know, permanent green card holder could have a Real ID. But if you don't have that, then you won't get a Real ID. So now moving forward, this is going to change a little bit. So where states still want to authorize that you can get a driver's license but don't have to have legal status, they're going to have to look a little bit different. Where in the past, you may not know, my California ID and this driver in this situation could look exactly the same, even though I was born in San Francisco and he was born somewhere else and did not have legal status to be in the country. Just equipping yourself with that knowledge is really important, because when we talk about sanctuary states or sanctuary cities, this is a little bit of what we're talking about, isn't it? That there's different ways that immigration laws are applied in different states. And this has been an ongoing tension between who gets to set those immigration laws and who gets to enforce them. The federal government and their, you know, whatever posture they're going to set during a certain administration, and how the states are going to handle that. And so the realization, again, 19 states authorize someone without a legal status to have a driver's license. It's just knowledge I don't think we talk about on a regular basis. And this goes into how different states are when they're approaching status. Does anyone have a question about that? Because when I was in New York City, we came across this in a few different ways about someone who had a driver's license but maybe didn't have legal status. And you wouldn't know the difference. I didn't even realize that that was the case, that you could get a driver's license and not necessarily have legal status. So this is an interesting question. So Dara says, I want to know more about his employer. Why was that company employing someone that was not legally authorized to work in the United States? That's an interesting question. And I would like to know a little bit more. We need to know more information. Dara, I don't know the answer to this right now, but let's say you're an employer that you're trying to get someone's work documentation, and they can give you a driver's license number, and they can give you an address, and they can give you a series of other things. Like, would you ask them whether or not they were legally in the country? Or would you just assume, well, they have their driver's license? And even if you didn't assume, you might say to yourself, well, is it legal for me to ask that question in certain states? And if someone had to get a driver's license and go through the training and, or, you know, had to take a test, then, well, they got a driver's license, didn't they? It's a very interesting topic. And again, something I don't think that we really think about. Natalia is saying this. I've had staff before and I always just assume, I guess I shouldn't. Yeah, it's interesting, Natalia. I don't know if anyone just like, now at this time moving ahead as an employer, if you see the Real ID, you know that there's lawful status. If you do not see the Real ID, then you have a question of, oh, why don't you have a Real ID? So again, that looks different depending on your employer. So all of you are prepping with a lot of really interesting questions about whether or not you can be on payroll. You know, what does this look like with, you know, whether or not you have the right documentation. Let's see this. I see Amy saying driver's license alone is not sufficient for filling out an I-9 form. I need to verify with Social Security and driver's license. That was it. Natalia said that. So this is, doesn't it open up your mind into a little bit of a way of thinking about, oh, I thought I knew about this topic, but I didn't know anything about it at all. I didn't realize that. So I wanted to underscore that because I thought there's a lot of back and forth about this horrific accident. You have this horrific video. It's getting a lot of play, no matter, you know, unfortunately, it's super, super dark. And you have this ongoing case, an example about, questions about immigration debate. But sometimes when we have that, we're devoid of a little bit of fact. And this is a fact that exists out there. So I wanted to equip you with it because I was always surprised about it. So I don't know exactly how this person was paid. And I'm sure there's a lot of other questions that are attached to this, but at least it gets you working a little bit about what laws are actually being enforced. In what states are there laws that are so different than other states that it's tough, you know, a federal law and a state law are in conflict? Let me just show you this. This is in Colorado. So this allows, and I can put this in our show notes so you can see it too. Colorado allows in a law individuals to qualify for a driver's license, instruction permit, or identification card despite the individual not being lawfully present or being only temporarily lawfully present in the United States if certain conditions are met, such as providing state tax returns. So then you may have a question, well, what about the state tax returns? How does one get that? Let's go to California. California is very vague. This law requires the Department of Motor Vehicles to issue driver's licenses to individuals who are ineligible for a Social Security number if the required documentation is provided. So we have to go and see what that documentation is. Oftentimes it's showing that you lived in the state for a certain period of time. Let's look at New York. This law authorizes the Department of Motor Vehicle to issue standard driver's licenses and restricts what information can be retained and given out on those applying or holding licenses. So it's interesting just to go through this and just seeing how different it is state to state. So something just to be aware of as we continue to watch which way this story goes and what happens next. And if there is actual legal consequence, and my husband was actually talking about this, I thought it was interesting about whether or not someone could sue the state of California for issuing a driver's license if issuing the driver's license was with someone that didn't have legal status who was then operating in a different state because the crime here was committed in Florida. So could be interesting to watch there. I don't know. We're not lawyers in my household. So we have a lot of different conversations regarding the news, but what's actually possible? I'll leave it to anyone. Attorneys that are joining us live can talk a little bit about that. What's the truth there? I'm very, very curious about that. So onwards on that. Okay, I want to show you one more thing today that I thought you'd find very, very interesting. And really, even though it is related to school, impacts all of our lives. And that is the use of a cell phone. This is a hot topic of conversation, and I'm showing you a graph on the screen now. So the hot topic is what sort of cell phone use is appropriate in schools, if any. And one of the news items that you should know is that we have more states this year than ever before putting forward certain restrictions regarding cell phones and schools. The Associated Press did an amazing report compiling all of this. And the map that you're seeing on your screen is showing the different approaches from a variety of different states. So you have 17 states with new restrictions this year. That's bringing the total number of states with restrictions or requirements regarding cell phones specifically to 35. The reason why this really matters in a myriad of different ways, but one of the reasons why this matters is that the first law we saw regarding cell phone use in schools only just passed in 2023. And so one of the observations of these new requirements or restrictions is how quickly this is coming into effect. So what you're seeing on your screen here is a breakdown. The red states have a school day ban. The orange states have an instructional time ban, so a certain period of the day. And then you have the yellow states that where the requirements or recommendations are related to local policy And then you have the gray states where there's nothing really on the books right now. So when I look at this map, something stands out to me. When we see social policy in America, often we see it break down among or by party line. So you see the red states doing something and you see the blue states doing something. And when I first looked at this map, especially with the color red being used, I thought, okay, all right, Texas, Louisiana, Florida, they're having a school day ban. Got it. Those are red states. But then you see Oregon, New York, and Vermont. These are solidly blue states, and they're doing exactly the same thing. So what we're seeing with cell phone policy related to schools in America this year is a trend that is crisscrossing not only the country, but also partisan lines. And we're seeing a movement that's changing this in schools rather quickly. If we dig down a little bit more, what about this local policy? We have some precedent for this because we know what happened during the pandemic when so many different school districts were doing something completely different. Depending on your state, the school districts could make certain decisions themselves and how they were going to educate during that time period. Well, this particular way, it's similar. So if I look at the state of Idaho, for example, the state of Idaho is leaving it to the local areas to make a decision for themselves. However, they're offering up to $5,000 per district for phone storage. So there's a little bit of incentive there. If you make the decision to restrict, there's some sort of incentive there. If I go up to Maine, Maine is requiring a local policy in next year's school year. So the cell phone ban status is that it's depending on your local school district, but by next year, they're going to have something in place, whatever that is. Let's look at California. California is very simple, requires a local policy. So the question there is, well, what are the different forces at play? And so one thing I just want to mention when we look at any sort of news story related to this topic, when you see the word school day ban, just be a little bit skeptical because in some places they're talking about K through 8. They're not talking about K through 12. So sometimes it just depends. It's elementary, middle, high school. It may look a little different, but it may still fall under a school day ban. In some cases, it'll be K through 12, but it may not be. So just a heads up on that. What's interesting is that there was a recent survey that was asking that question about how, you know, what was kind of the resistance to cell phone bans at school. And it turns out it wasn't the students and it wasn't the teachers. It was the parents. The parents were the ones that had the most issue with having a cell phone ban at schools or restrictions in certain ways. And in this particular article, one of the mothers speaks out and says, you know, I am worried about it. I'd like to have more access to my daughter at school. And I am worried about violence on campus. And I like having that ability to access her and to be in touch with her during the school day. That's all. And my question for you is, what do you think about that? Because this is schools, and obviously these are minors, so you have adults making decisions for them. But I can't help but wonder about, well, could we start seeing this apply to other areas? You know, other places of business. I went to a concert in Las Vegas a couple of years ago, and they required you, you might have experienced this too, you have to put it in a magnetic pouch. So you have to lock your cell phone in the pouch. And you got to hold it, but you couldn't access it. And the performer said, I want you to be totally focused on having a great time. Everything is going to be okay in the next hour and a half. It's going to be fine. And the reality is that concert compared to another one I saw where everyone had their cell phones out filming the performer, even though it's going to be really bad footage and you're not going to be able to really share it that much. It was a totally different experience. And in order to attend the concert, that's what you had to do. So could we actually see this not just in places of work or business, but also speaking of places of work, for example, in your office? There was a time not that long ago that all of us didn't have instant access. But what does that look like? You know, what does that look like? And how is AI potentially going to change that conversation completely anyways? Because we're going to have new devices, we're going to have new ways of being in touch that maybe we can't even really think about right now. No one was really thinking, oh, my kid's going to carry an iPhone to school. I remember when the iPhones came out, I didn't have one. The work issued a BlackBerry, which I still miss, by the way, not to date myself, but those BlackBerries were great. You couldn't really surf the web. You couldn't really shop, but you could really type an email. Let me tell you, I love those things. But then the iPhone price came down and I was able to get an iPhone as well. But I wouldn't even at that time have imagined, oh, you know, a family is going to have six iPhones or whatever it is. But things change. So I'm very curious what your thoughts are about this story and what you think about this being a very new change for this school year. Barbara's asking, why do we feel like we need instant access? That's a question. Like, why do we feel like we need instant access to people? What did we do in the past? Remember when people like would go to the trading post? They'd be gone for several weeks. May never see them again. Like that. Maybe it's the trauma from that time period, Barbara. We're like, we kind of just want to know, like, when you're coming back for dinner. You know, is that it? Leanne, thank you for the support about the BlackBerry. Tawny also. I mean, maybe we need to have the BlackBerries come back, right? You can still call each other, but we didn't do all the things on it. So again, new year, new change, seeing something different. We'll get some more data about what this looks like in schools, how families feel about it. And just as quickly as we slipped into phones being at schools, are we going to kind of slip out of it? And we're going to realize that that's not going to be the case. So we'll see. We'll see what happens next. I'm going to finish on this quick, also something new. I want to talk to you about this as I leave that map up. You may not realize that just over the last several days, we have a new head of a certain department in government that was just created through executive action. And this head is the U.S. Chief Design Officer. The goal of this department is trying to make, speaking of cell phones and access and all the things, you know, President Trump wants to remake certain parts of the White House. He also wants your experience when you jump on a federal government website to be beautiful and to be easy to use. And so the former founder of Airbnb, Joe Gebbia, was named the first U.S. Chief Design Officer. And he says he wants to update federal websites. He was telling this to Axios, to an Apple Store-like experience. That means it's beautifully designed, he said, has great user experience, and it runs on modern software. And that's just not the experience of American citizens. When we jump on a government website, do we think this is going to be awesome, or do we think something different? So the chief design officer is going to report to the White House chief of staff. They're going to hire creative talent from the private sector. They're going to recruit. This is, again, I'm reading off a report that from Axios that's also quoting the White House, the most talented designers of our generation to serve their country. America by Design is a national initiative to update the government's design language to be both usable and beautiful. And there's going to be a national design studio within the White House to help push forward this agenda. So what are your thoughts about this? And where would you start first? That's what I want. You know, a lot of the different departments have different styles on their websites. Some of them are really great. Some of them not so good. So where would you start? And what do you want to fix first? And what do you think about this? Also, I don't know what his salary is. So there's we got payroll here. I know we were trying to shrink the federal government, but this is I know the agenda by the Trump administration was, you know, Doge. We're going to get efficient. But they're also adding back some other things as well. Here's what Axios says, calling the bottom line. Heads of agencies are supposed to produce their initial design revamps by July 4th next year. That's marking America's 250th birthday. And so this is all going to be part of this design refresh that apparently is taking place when it comes to the federal government. So your thoughts on that? Kind of cool job, right? You found Airbnb, and then you're going to kind of be part of a new image for the United States of America. And what is that going to look like? So Peggy says she would start with the IRS and Social Security. I think those do not scream easy or beautiful, do they, Peggy? So I like that. Jenny B says, it's horrible. Our federal workers deserve better technology, let alone us as citizens getting into these sites. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Can you imagine that the IRS has the most beautiful design of anything? There's something good to that. So I'll leave it with you to think about as you start seeing some changes. This could be some of the reasons why. In the meantime, I think we did pretty good. We covered a lot of big topics today. Thank you for your support. As always, we will not be doing Scoop on Labor Day. Most of you have the day off. You're enjoying that 3-day weekend before we get into fall. So we will do Scoop on Tuesday next week. So you have a little extra time with the family or a little time maybe to check out. Maybe you're going to park your phone. You know, maybe you're going to have like your own ban in your household. I had a friend, my friend Georgia just told me that she had a no screen policy on a vacation with her family and they had great success, really, really good success with it. So it feels hard at the beginning, but then maybe the payoff is where it's at. So I look forward to your feedback on that. Thank you so much for your support of Quick, Concise, Nonpartisan, Smarter News. Thanks for hanging around today with us. And if you'd like any more information, always visit smarternews.com. I hope you have a great day, and I hope you stay safe with that weather. Not too hot in the Pacific Northwest. Not too many flash floods. We've covered enough of that. So I really hope everyone really stays safe. And where appropriate, you can throw on a little sweatshirt or something. That would be great. If you see any great fall photos, send them our way. We'd love to share those. But have a great week, you guys. I'll see you soon with more Smarter News. Bye.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money.